Where should I start looking? Asked Caroline. Where you wish, said her other mother, as if she did not care at all. Caroline looked at her, and Caroline thought hard. There was no point, she decided, to exploring the garden and the grounds. They didn't exist. They weren't real. There were no abandoned tennis courts in the other mother's world, no bottomless well. All that was real was the house itself. She walked into the kitchen and looked around. She opened the oven, peered into the freezer, poked into the salad compartment of the fridge. The other mother followed her in and stood looking at Caroline with a smirk hovering at the edge of her lips. How big are souls, anyway? Asked Caroline. The other mother sat down at the kitchen table and leaned back against the wall, saying nothing. She picked at her teeth with a long crimson varnished fingernail, then she tapped the finger gently, tap, 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 against the polished black surface of her black button eyes. Fine, said Caroline. Don't tell me. I don't care. It doesn't matter if you help me or not. Everyone knows that a soul is the same size as a beach ball. She was hoping the other mother would say something like, Nonsense, they're the size of ripe onions, or suitcases, or grandfather clocks. But the other mother simply smiled, and the tap-tap-tapping of her fingernail against her eye was as steady and relentless as the drip of water droplets from the faucet into the sink. And then Caroline realized it was simply the noise of the water, and she was alone in the room. Caroline shivered. She preferred the other mother to have a location. If she were nowhere, then she could be anywhere. And after all, it's always easier to be afraid of something you cannot see. She put her hands into her pockets, and her fingers closed around the reassuring shape of the stone with the hole in it. She pulled it out of her pocket, held it in front of her, as if she were holding a gun, and walked out into the hall. There was no sound but the tap-tap of the water dripping from the faucet into the metal sink. She glanced at the mirror at the end of the hall. For a moment it clouded over, and it seemed to her that faces swam in the glass, indistinct and shapeless, and then the faces were gone, and there was nothing in the mirror but a girl who was small for her age, holding something that glowed gently, like a green coal. Caroline looked down at her hand, surprised. It was just a stone with a hole in it, a nondescript brown pebble. Then she looked back in the mirror, where it glimmered like an emerald. A trail of green fire blew from the pebble in the mirror and drifted toward Caroline's bedroom. Hmm, said Caroline. She walked into the bedroom. The toys fluttered excitedly as she walked in, as if they were pleased to see her, and a little tank rolled out of the toy box to greet her, its tread rolling over several other toys. It fell from the toy box onto the floor, tipping as it fell, and it lay on the carpet like a beetle on its back, grumbling and grinding its treads before Caroline picked it up and turned it over. The tank fled under the bed in embarrassment. Caroline looked around the room. She looked in the cupboards and the drawers. Then she picked up one end of the toy box and tipped all the toys in it out onto the carpet, where they grumbled and stretched and wiggled awkwardly free of each other. A grey marble rolled across the floor and clicked against the wall. None of the toys looked particularly soul-like, she thought. She picked up and examined a silver charm bracelet, from which hung tiny animal charms which chased each other round the perimeter of the bracelet, the fox never catching the rabbit, the bear never gaining on the fox. Caroline opened her hand and looked at the stone with the hole in it, hoping for a clue but not finding one. Most of the toys that had been in the toy box had now crawled away to hide under the bed, and the few toys that were left, a green plastic soldier, the glass marble, a vivid pink yo-yo, and such, were the kind of things you find in the bottoms of toy boxes in the real world. Forgotten objects, abandoned and unloved. She was about to leave and look elsewhere, And then she remembered a voice in the darkness, a gentle whispering voice, and what it had told her to do. She picked up the stone with a hole in it and held it in front of her right eye. She closed her left eye and looked at the room through the hole in the stone. Through the stone, the world was grey and colourless, like a pencil drawing. Everything in it was grey. No, not quite everything. Something glinted on the floor, something the colour of an ember in a nursery fireplace, the colour of a scarlet and orange tulip, nodding in the May sun. Coraline reached out her left hand, scared that if she took her eye off it, it would vanish, and she fumbled for the burning thing. Her fingers closed about something smooth and cool. She snatched it up, and then lowered the stone with a hole in it from her eye and looked down. The grey glass marble from the bottom of the toy box sat, dully, in the pink palm of her hand. She raised the stone to her eye once more and looked through it at the marble. Once again the marble burned and flickered with a red fire. A voice whispered in her mind. "Indeed, lady, it comes to me that I certainly was a boy. Now I do think on it. Oh, but you must hurry! There are two of us still to find, and the beldam is already angry with you for uncovering me." "If I'm going to do this," thought Coraline, "I'm not going to do it in her clothes." She changed back into her pyjamas, her dressing gown and her slippers, leaving the grey sweater and the black jeans neatly folded up on the bed, the orange boots on the floor by the toy box. She put the marble into her dressing gown pocket and walked out into the hall. Something stung her face and hands, like sand blowing on a beach on a windy day. She covered her eyes and pushed forward. The sand stings got worse, and it got harder and harder to walk, as if she were pushing into the wind on a particularly blustery day. It was a vicious wind and a cold one. She took a step backwards, the way she'd come. "Oh, keep going," whispered a ghost voice in her ear. "For the beldam is angry." She stepped forward in the hallway, into another gust of wind which stung her cheeks and face with invisible sand, sharp as needles, sharp as glass. "Play fair!" shouted Coraline into the wind. There was no reply, but the wind whipped about her one more time, petulantly, and then it dropped away and was gone. As she passed the kitchen, Coraline could hear, in the sudden silence, the drip-drip of the water from the leaking faucet, or perhaps the other mother's long fingernails tapping impatiently against the table. Coraline resisted the urge to look. In a couple of strides, she reached the front door, and she walked outside. Coraline went outside, down the steps and around the house, until she reached Miss Spink and Miss Forcible's flat. The lamps around the door were flickering on and off almost randomly now, spelling out no words that Coraline could understand. The door was closed. She was afraid it was locked, and she pushed on it with all her strength. First it stuck, then suddenly it gave, and with a jerk, Coraline stumbled into the dark room beyond. Coraline closed one hand around the stone with the hole in it and walked forward into blankness. She expected to find a curtained anteroom, but there was nothing there. The room was dark. The theatre was empty. She moved ahead cautiously. Something rustled above her. She looked up into a deeper darkness, and as she did so, her feet knocked against something. She reached down, picked up a flashlight, and clicked it on, sweeping the beam around the room. The theatre was derelict and abandoned. Chairs were broken on the floor, and old, dusty spider webs draped the walls and hung from the rotten wood and the decomposing velvet hangings. Something rustled once again. Coraline directed her light beam upwards towards the ceiling. There were things up there, hairless, jellyish. She thought they might once have had faces, might even once have been dogs. But no dogs had wings, like bats, or could hang, like spiders, like bats, upside down. The light startled the creatures, and one of them took to the air, its wings whirring heavily through the dust. Caroline ducked as it swooped close to her. It came to rest on a far wall, and it began to clamber upside down back to the nest of the dog bats upon the ceiling. Caroline raised the stone to her eye, and she scanned the room through it, looking for something that glowed or glinted, a telltale sign that somewhere in this room was another hidden soul. She ran the beam of the flashlight about the room as she searched, the thick dust in the air making the light beam seem almost solid. There was something up on the back wall, behind the ruined stage. It was greyish-white, twice the size of Caroline herself, and it was stuck to the back wall like a slug. Caroline took a deep breath. "I'm not afraid," she told herself. "I'm not." She did not believe herself, but she scrambled up onto the old stage, fingers sinking into the rotting wood as she pulled herself up. As she got closer to the thing on the wall, she saw that it was some kind of a sack, like a spider's egg case. It twitched in the light beam. Inside the sack was something that looked like a person, but a person with two heads, with twice as many arms and legs as it should have. The creature in the sack seemed horribly unformed and unfinished, as if two plasticine people had been warmed and rolled together, squashed and pressed into one thing. Caroline hesitated. She did not want to approach the thing. The dog bats dropped, one by one, from the ceiling, and began to circle the room, coming close to her but never touching her. "Perhaps there are no souls hidden in here," she thought. "Perhaps I can just leave and go somewhere else." She took a last look through the hole in the stone. The abandoned theatre was a bleak grey, but there was a brown glow, as rich and bright as polished cherry wood, coming from inside the sack. Whatever was glowing was being held in one of the hands of the thing on the wall. Caroline walked slowly across the damp stage, trying to make as little sound as she could, afraid that if she disturbed the thing in the sack it would open its eyes and see her and then... But there was nothing that she could think of as scary as having it look at her. Her heart pounded in her chest. She took another step forward. She'd never been so scared, but still she walked forward until she reached the sack. Then she pushed her hand into the sticky, clinging whiteness of the stuff on the wall. It crackled, softly, like a tiny fire, as she pushed, and it clung to her skin and clothes like a spider web clings, like white cotton candy. She pushed her hand into it, and she reached upward until she touched a cold hand, which was, she could feel, closed around another glass marble. The creature's skin felt slippery, as if it had been covered in jelly. Caroline tugged at the marble. At first nothing happened. It was held tight in the creature's grasp. Then one by one the fingers loosened their grip, and the marble slipped into her hand. She pulled her arm back through the sticky webbing, relieved that the thing's eyes had not opened. She shone the light on its faces. They resembled, she decided, the younger versions of Miss Spink and Miss Forcible, but twisted and squeezed together like two lumps of wax that had melted and melded together into one ghastly thing. Without warning, one of the creature's hands made a grab for Caroline's arm. Its fingernails scraped her skin, but it was too slippery to grip, and Caroline pulled away successfully. And then the eyes opened. Four black buttons glinting and staring down at her, and two voices that sounded like no voice that Caroline had ever heard began to speak to her. One of them wailed and whispered, the other buzzed like a fat and angry blue bottle at a window pane, but the voices said, as one person, "Thief! Give it back! Stop! Thief!" The air became alive with dog bats. Caroline began to back away. She realized then that, terrifying though the thing on the wall that had once been the other Mrs. Spink and Forcible was, it was attached to the wall by its web, encased in its cocoon. It could not follow her. The dog bats flapped and fluttered about her, but they did nothing to hurt Caroline. She climbed down from the stage, shone the flashlight about the old theatre, looking for the way out. "Flee, miss," wailed a girl's voice in her head. Flee, now! You have two of us. Flee this place while your blood still flows. Coraline dropped the marble into her pocket, beside the other. She spotted the door, ran to it, and pulled on it until it opened. Chapter 9. Outside, the world had become a formless, swirling mist, with no shapes or shadows behind it, while the house itself seemed to have twisted and stretched. It seemed to Coraline that it was crouching and staring down at her, as if it were not really a house, but only the idea of a house. And the person who had had the idea, she was certain, was not a good person. There was sticky web stuff clinging to her arm, and she wiped it off as best she could. The grey windows of the house slanted at strange angles. The other mother was waiting for her, standing on the grass with her arms folded. Her black button eyes were expressionless, but her lips were pressed tightly together in a cold fury. When she saw Coraline, she reached out one long white hand and she crooked a finger. Coraline walked toward her. The other mother said nothing.
"I got two," said Coraline. "One soul still to go."
The expression on the other mother's face did not change. She might not have heard what Coraline said.
"Well, I just thought you'd want to know," said Coraline.
"Thank you, Coraline," said the other mother coldly, and her voice did not just come from her mouth. It came from the mist and the fog and the house and the sky. She said, "You know that I love you." And despite herself, Coraline nodded. It was true. The other mother loved her. But she loved Coraline as a miser loves money, or a dragon loves its gold. In the other mother's button eyes, Coraline knew that she was a possession, nothing more, a tolerated pet whose behaviour was no longer amusing.
"I don't want your love," said Coraline. "I don't want anything from you."
"Not even a helping hand?" asked the other mother. "You have been doing so well, after all. I thought you might want a little hint to help you with the rest of your treasure hunt."
"I'm doing fine on my own," said Coraline.
"Yes," said the other mother. "But if you wanted to get into the flat in the front, the empty one, to look around, you would find the door locked. And then where would you be?"
"Oh."
Coraline pondered this for a moment. Then she said, "Is there a key?" The other mother stood there in the paper-grey fog of the flattening world. Her black hair drifted about her head as if it had a mind and a purpose all of its own. She coughed suddenly in the back of her throat, and then she opened her mouth. The other mother reached up her hand and removed a small brass front door key from her tongue.
"Here," she said, "you'll need this to get in."
She tossed the key casually towards Coraline, who caught it one-handed before she could think about whether she wanted it or not. The key was still slightly damp. A chill wind blew about them, and Coraline shivered and looked away. When she looked up, she was alone. Uncertainly, she walked around to the front of the house and stood in front of the door to the empty flat. Like all the doors, it was painted bright green. She wondered if this was some kind of trick.
"She does not mean you well,"
whispered a ghost voice in her ear.
"We do not believe that she would help you. It must be a trick."
Coraline said, "Yes, you're right, I expect." Then she put the key in the lock and turned it. Silently, the door swung open, and silently Coraline walked inside. The flat had walls the colour of old milk. The wooden boards of the floor were uncarpeted and dusty with the marks and patterns of old carpets and rugs on them. There was no furniture in there, only places where furniture had once been,
Nothing decorated the walls. There were discoloured rectangles on the walls to show where paintings or photographs had once hung. It was so silent that Coraline imagined that she could hear the motes of dust drifting through the air. She found herself to be quite worried that something would jump out at her, so she began to whistle. She thought it might make it harder for things to jump out at her if she was whistling. First, she walked through the empty kitchen. Then she walked through an empty bathroom, containing only a cast-iron bath and, in the bath, a dead spider the size of a small cat. The last room she looked at had, she supposed, once been a bedroom. She could imagine that the rectangular dust shadow on the floorboards had once been a bed. Then she saw something and smiled grimly. Set into the floorboards was a large metal ring. Coraline knelt and took the cold ring in her hands, and she tugged upward as hard as she could. Terribly slowly, stiffly, heavily, a hinged square of floor lifted. It was a trapdoor. It lifted, and through the opening Coraline could see only darkness. She reached down, and her hand found a cold switch. She flicked it without much hope that it would work, but somewhere below her a bulb lit, and a thin yellow light came up from the hole in the floor. She could see steps heading down, but nothing else. Coraline put her hand into her pocket and took out the stone with the hole in it. She looked through it at the cellar, but saw nothing. She put the stone back in her pocket. Up through the hole came the smell of damp clay, and something else, an acrid tang like sour vinegar. Coraline let herself down into the hole, looking nervously at the trap door. It was so heavy that if it fell, she was sure she'd be trapped down in the darkness forever. She put up a hand and touched it, but it stayed in position. And then she turned towards the darkness below, and she walked down the steps. Set into the wall at the bottom of the steps was another light switch, metal and rusting, and she pushed it until it clicked down and a naked bulb hanging from a wire from the low ceiling came on. It did not give up enough light, even for Coraline to make out the things that had been painted onto the flaking cellar walls. The paintings seemed crude. There were eyes, she could see that, and things that might have been grapes, and other things below them. Coraline could not be sure that they were paintings of people. There was a pile of rubbish in one corner of the room, cardboard boxes filled with mildewed papers and decaying curtains in a heap beside them. Coraline's shoes crunched across the cement floor. The bad smell was worse now. She was ready to turn and leave when she saw the foot sticking out from beneath the pile of curtains. She took a deep breath. The smells of sour wine and mouldy bread filled her head, and she pulled away the damp cloth to reveal something more or less the size and shape of a person. In that dim light, it took her several seconds to recognize it for what it was. The thing was pale and swollen like a grub, with thin, stick-like arms and feet. It had almost no features on its face, which had puffed and swollen like risen bread. The thing had two large black buttons where its eyes should have been. Coraline made a noise, a sound of revulsion and horror. And as if it had heard her and awakened, the thing began to sit up. Coraline stood there, frozen. The thing turned its head until both its black button eyes were pointed straight at her. A mouth opened in the mouthless face, strands of pale stuff sticking to the lips, and a voice that no longer even faintly resembled her father's whispered, "Coraline!" "Well," said Coraline to the thing that had once been her other father, "at least you didn't jump out at me." The creature's twig-like hands moved to its face and pushed the pale clay about, making something like a nose. It said nothing. "I'm looking for my parents," said Coraline, "or a stolen soul from one of the other children. Are they down here?"
"There is nothing down here," said the pale thing indistinctly. "Nothing but dust and damp and forgetting.
The thing was white and huge and swollen. Monstrous, thought Coraline, but also miserable. She raised the stone with the hole in it to her eye and looked through it. Nothing. The pale thing was telling her the truth. Poor thing, she said. I bet she made you come down here as a punishment for telling me too much. The thing hesitated. Then it nodded. Coraline wondered how she could ever have imagined that this grub-like thing resembled her father. I'm so sorry, she said.
She's not best pleased, said the thing that was once the other father. Not best pleased at all. You've put her quite out of sorts, and when she gets out of sorts, she takes it out on everybody else. It's her way.
Coraline patted its hairless head. Its skin was tacky like warm bread dough. Poor thing, she said. You're just a thing she made, and then threw away. The thing nodded vigorously. As it nodded, the left button eye fell off and clattered onto the concrete floor. The thing looked around vacantly with its one eye, as if it had lost her. Finally, it saw her. And as if making a great effort, it opened its mouth once more and said in a wet, urgent voice,
Run, child! Leave this place! She wants me to hurt you, to keep you here forever, so that you can never finish the game, and she will win. She is pushing me so hard to hurt you. I cannot fight her.
You can, said Coraline. Be brave. She looked around. The thing that had once been the other father was between her and the steps up and out of the cellar. She started edging along the wall, heading toward the steps. The thing twisted, bonelessly, until its one eye was again facing her. It seemed to be getting bigger now and more awake.
Alas, it said, I cannot.
And it lunged across the cellar towards her then, its toothless mouth opened wide. Coraline had a single heartbeat in which to react. She could only think of two things to do. Either she could scream and try to run away, and be chased around a badly lit cellar by the huge grub thing, be chased until it caught her. Or she could do something else. So she did something else. As the thing reached her, Coraline put out her hand and closed it around the thing's remaining button eye, and she tugged as hard as she knew how. For a moment, nothing happened. Then the button came away and flew from her hand, clicking against the brickwork before it fell to the cellar floor. The thing froze in place. It threw its pale head back blindly and opened its mouth horribly wide, and it roared its anger and frustration. Then, all in a rush, the thing swept toward the place that Coraline had been standing. But Coraline was not standing there any longer. She was already tiptoeing, as quietly as she could, up the steps that would take her away from the dim cellar with the crude paintings on the walls. She could not take her eyes from the floor beneath her, though, across which a pale thing flopped and writhed, hunting for her. Then, as if it was being told what to do, the creature stopped moving, and its blind head tipped to one side. It's listening for me, thought Coraline. I must be extra quiet. She took another step up and backward, and her foot slipped on the step, and the thing heard her. Its head tipped toward her. For a moment it swayed and seemed to be gathering its wits, and then fast as a serpent it slithered for the steps and began to flow up them toward her. Coraline turned and ran wildly up the last half dozen steps, and she pushed herself up and onto the floor of the dusty bedroom. Without pausing, she pulled the heavy trapdoor toward her and let go of it. It crashed down with a thump, just as something large banged against it. The trapdoor shook and rattled in the floor, but it stayed where it was. Coraline took a deep breath. If there had been any furniture in that flat, even a chair, she would have pulled it onto the trapdoor, but there was nothing. She walked out of that flat as fast as she could, without actually ever running, and she locked the front door behind her. She left the door key under the mat, and she walked down onto the drive. She had half expected that the other mother would be standing there, waiting for Coraline to come out, but the world was silent and empty. Coraline wanted to go home. She hugged herself and told herself that she was brave, and she almost believed herself. And then she walked around to the side of the house, in the grey mist that wasn't a mist, and she made for the stairs to go up.
In the talking garden, many pretty things grow. I think you want me to be your garden gnome. You want me to be your plastic flamingo. You are not my mother, and I want to go home. You are not my mother, and I want to go home.
Chapter 10. Coraline walked up the stairs outside the building to the topmost flat where, in her world, the crazy old man upstairs lived. She'd gone up there once with her real mother when her mother was collecting for charity. They'd stood in the open doorway waiting for the crazy old man with the big moustache to find the envelope that Coraline's mother had left. And the flat had smelled of strange foods and pipe tobacco and odd, sharp, cheesy-smelling things which Coraline could not name. She had not wanted to go any further inside than that. "I'm an explorer," said Coraline out loud, but her words sounded muffled and dead on the misty air. She'd made it out of the cellar, hadn't she? And she had, but if there was one thing that Coraline was certain of, it was that this flat would be worse. She reached the top of the house. The topmost flat had once been the attic of the house, but that was long ago. She knocked on the green-painted door. It swung open, and she walked in.
"We have eyes and we have nerves. We have tails, we have teeth. You'll all get what you deserves is when we rise from underneath,"
whispered a dozen or more tiny voices in that dark flat, with the roof so low where it met the walls that Coraline could almost reach up and touch it. Red eyes stared at her. Little pink feet scurried away as she came close. Darker shadows slipped through the shadows at the edges of things. It smelt much worse in here than in the real crazy old man upstairs flat. That smelled of food. Unpleasant food, to Coraline's mind, but she knew that was a matter of taste. She did not like spices, herbs, or exotic things. This place smelled as if all the exotic foods in the world had been left out to go rotten.
"Little girl,"
said a rustling voice in a far room. Yes, said Coraline. I'm not frightened, she told herself. And as she thought it, she knew that it was true. There was nothing here that frightened her. These things, even the thing in the cellar, were illusions, things made by the other mother in a ghastly parody of the real people and real things on the other end of the corridor. She could not truly make anything, decided Coraline. She could only twist and copy and distort things that already existed. And then Coraline found herself wondering why the other mother would have placed a snow globe on the drawing room mantelpiece, for the mantelpiece in Coraline's world was quite bare. As soon as she'd asked herself the question, she realized that there was actually an answer. Then the voice came again, and her train of thought was interrupted.
Come here, little girl. I know what you want, little girl.
It was a rustling voice, scratchy and dry. It made Coraline think of some kind of enormous dead insect, which was silly, she knew. How could a dead thing, especially a dead insect, have a voice? She walked through several rooms with low, slanting ceilings until she came to the last room. It was a bedroom, and the other crazy old man upstairs sat at the far end of the room, in the near darkness, bundled up in his coat and hat. As Coraline entered, he began to talk.
"Nothing's changed, little girl," he said,
his voice sounding like the noise dry leaves make as they rustle across a pavement.
"And what if you do everything you swore you would? What then? Nothing's changed. You'll go home. You'll be bored. You'll be ignored. No one will listen to you, not really listen to you. You're too clever and too quiet for them to understand. They don't even get your name right." "Stay here with us," said the voice from the figure at the end of the room. "We will listen to you and play with you and laugh with you. Your other mother will build whole worlds for you to explore and tear them down every night when you are done. Every day will be better and brighter than the one that went before. Remember the toy box? How much better would a world be built just like that? And all for you."
"And will there be grey, wet days, where I just don't know what to do, and there's nothing to read or to watch, and nowhere to go, and the day drags on forever?" asked Coraline. From the shadows, the man said,
"Never."
"And will there be awful meals, with food made from recipes, with garlic and tarragon and broad beans in?" asked Coraline.
"Every meal will be a thing of joy," whispered the voice from under the old man's hat. "Nothing will pass your lips that does not entirely delight you."
"And could I have day-glow green gloves to wear, and yellow Wellington boots in the shape of frogs?" asked Coraline.
"Frogs, ducks, rhinos, octopuses, whatever you desire. The world will be built new for you every morning. If you stay here, you can have whatever you want."
Coraline sighed. "You really don't understand, do you?" she said. "I don't want whatever I want. Nobody does. Not really. What kind of fun would it be if I just got everything I ever wanted, just like that, and it didn't mean anything? What then?"
"I don't understand," said the whispery voice.
"Of course you don't understand," she said, raising the stone with the hole in it to her eye. "You're just a bad copy she made of the crazy old man upstairs." There was a glow coming from the raincoat of the man at about chest height. Through the hole in the stone, the glow twinkled and shone blue-white as any star. She wished she had a stick or something to poke him with. She had no wish to get any closer to the shadowy man at the end of the room. Not even that anymore, said the dead, whispery voice.
Coraline took a step closer to the man, and he fell apart. Black rats leapt from the sleeves and from under the coat and hat, a score or more of them, red eyes shining in the dark. They chittered, and they fled. The coat fluttered and fell heavily to the floor. The hat rolled into one corner of the room. Coraline reached out one hand and pulled the coat open. It was empty, although it was greasy to the touch. There was no sign of the final glass marble in it. She scanned the room, squinting through the hole in the stone, and caught sight of something that twinkled and burned like a star at floor level by the doorway. It was being carried in the forepaws of the largest black rat. As she looked, it slipped away. The other rats watched her from the corners of the rooms as she ran after it. Now, rats can run faster than people, especially over short distances. But a large black rat holding a marble in its two front paws is no match for a determined girl, even if she is small for her age, moving at a run. Smaller black rats ran back and forwards across her path, trying to distract her, but she ignored them all, keeping her eyes fixed on the one with the marble who was heading straight out of the flat toward the front door. They reached the steps on the outside of the building. Coraline had time to observe that the house itself was continuing to change, becoming less distinct and flattening out, even as she raced down the stairs. It reminded her of a photograph of a house now, not the thing itself. Then she was simply racing pell-mell down the steps in pursuit of the rat, with no room in her mind for anything else, certain she was gaining on it. She was running fast, too fast, she discovered, as she came to the bottom of one flight of stairs, and her foot skidded and twisted, and she went crashing onto the concrete landing. Her left knee was scraped and skinned, and the palm of one hand she'd thrown out to stop herself was a mess of scraped skin and grit. It hurt a little, and it would, she knew, soon hurt much more. She picked the grit out of her palm and climbed to her feet, and as fast as she could, knowing that she'd lost and it was already too late, she went down the final landing to the ground level. She looked around for the rat, but it was gone, and the marble with it. Her hand stung where the skin had been scraped, and there was blood trickling down her ripped pajama leg from her knee. It was as bad as the summer that her mother had taken the training wheels off Coraline's bicycle. But then, back then, in with all the cuts and scrapes, her knees had had scabs on top of scabs. She had had a feeling of achievement. She was learning something, doing something she'd not known how to do. Now she felt nothing but cold loss. She'd failed the ghost children. She'd failed her parents. She'd failed herself. Failed everything. She closed her eyes and wished that the earth would swallow her up. There was a cough. She opened her eyes and saw the rat. It was lying on the brick path at the bottom of the stairs with a surprised look on its face, which was now several inches away from the rest of it. Its whiskers were stiff, its eyes were wide open, its teeth visible and yellow and sharp. A collar of wet blood glistened at its neck. Beside the decapitated rat, a smug expression on its face was the black cat. It rested one paw on the grey glass marble. "I think I once mentioned," said the cat, "that I don't like rats at the best of times. It looked like you needed this one, however. I hope you don't mind my getting involved."
"I think," said Coraline, trying to catch her breath, "I think you may have said something of the sort."
The cat lifted its paw from the marble, which rolled toward Coraline. She picked it up. In her mind, a final voice whispered to her urgently,
"She has lied to you. She will never give you up, now she has you. She will no more give any of us up than she can change her nature."
The hairs on the back of Coraline's neck prickled, and Coraline knew that the girl's voice told the truth. She put the marble in her dressing gown pocket with the others. She had all three marbles now. All she needed to do was to find her parents. And, Coraline realized with surprise, that bit was easy. She knew exactly where her parents were. If she'd stopped to think, she might have known where they were all along. The other mother could not create. She could only transform and twist and change. The mantelpiece in the drawing room back home was quite empty. But knowing that, she knew something else as well.
The other mother, she plans to break her promise. She won't let us go, said Coraline.
I wouldn't put it past her, admitted the cat. Like I said, there's no guarantee she'll play fair. And then he raised his head. Hello, did you see that?
What?
Look behind you, said the cat. The house had flattened out even more. It no longer looked like a photograph, more like a drawing, a crude charcoal scribble of a house drawn on grey paper.
Whatever's happening, said Coraline, thank you for helping with the rat. I suppose I'm almost there, aren't I? So, you go off into the mist or wherever you go, and I hope I get to see you at home, if she lets me go home.
The cat's fur was on end, and its tail was bristling like a chimney sweep's brush.
What's wrong?
Asked Coraline. They've gone, said the cat. They aren't there any more. The ways in and out of this place. They just went flat.
Is that bad?
The cat lowered its tail, swishing it from side to side angrily. It made a low growling noise in the back of its throat. It walked in a circle until it was facing away from Coraline, and then it began to walk backwards, stiffly, one step at a time, until it was pushing up against Coraline's leg. She put down a hand to stroke it and could feel how hard its heart was beating. It was trembling, like a dead leaf in a storm.
You'll be fine, said Coraline. Everything's going to be fine. I'll take you home.
The cat said nothing.
Come on, cat, said Coraline.
She took a step back toward the steps, but the cat stayed where it was, looking miserable and, oddly, much smaller.
If the only way out is past her, said Coraline, then that's the way we're going to go.
She went back to the cat, bent down and picked it up. The cat did not resist. It simply trembled. She supported its bottom with one hand, rested its front legs on her shoulders. The cat was heavy, but not too heavy to carry. It licked at the palm of her hand, where the blood from the scrape was welling up. Coraline walked up the stairs, one step at a time, heading back to her own flat. She was aware of the marbles clicking in her pocket, aware of the stone with a hole in it, aware of the cat pressing itself against her. She got to her front door, now just a small child scrawl of a door, and she pushed her hand against it, half expecting that her hand would rip through it, revealing nothing behind it but blackness and a scattering of stars. But the door swung open, and Coraline went through. Chapter 11. Once inside, in her flat, or rather, in the flat that was not hers, Coraline was pleased to see that it had not transformed into the empty drawing that the rest of the house seemed to have become. It had depth and shadows, and someone who stood in the shadows waiting for Coraline to return.
So you're back, said the other mother.
She did not sound pleased.
And you brought vermin with you?
No, said Coraline. I brought a friend. She could feel the cat stiffening under her hands, as if it were anxious to be away. Coraline wanted to hold on to it like a teddy bear, for reassurance. But she knew that cats hate to be squeezed, and she suspected that frightened cats were liable to bite and scratch if provoked in any way, even if they were on your side.
"You know I love you," said the other mother flatly.
"You have a very funny way of showing it," said Coraline. She walked down the hallway, then turned into the drawing room, steady step by steady step, pretending that she could not feel the other mother's blank black eyes on her back. Her grandmother's formal furniture was still there, and the paintings on the wall of the strange fruit. But now the fruit in the painting had been eaten, and all that remained in the bowl was the browning core of an apple, several plum and peach stones, and the stem of what had formerly been a bunch of grapes. The lion-pawed wooden table raked the carpet with its clawed wooden feet as if it were impatient for something. At the end of the room, in the corner, stood the wooden door which had once, in another place, opened onto a plain brick wall. Coraline tried not to stare at it. The window showed nothing but mist. This was it, Coraline knew. The moment of truth. The unravelling time. The other mother had followed her in. Now she stood in the centre of the room, between Coraline and the mantelpiece, and looked down at Coraline with black button eyes. It was funny, Coraline thought. The other mother did not look anything at all like her own mother. She wondered how she had ever been deceived into seeing a resemblance. The other mother was huge, her head almost brushed the ceiling of the room, and very pale, the colour of a spider's belly. Her hair writhed and twined about her head, and her teeth were sharp as knives. "Well," said the other mother sharply, "where are they?" Coraline leaned against an armchair, adjusted the cat with her left hand, put her right hand into her pocket, and pulled out the three glass marbles. They were a frosted grey, and they clinked together in the palm of her hand. The other mother reached her white fingers for them, but Coraline slipped them back into her pocket. She knew it was true, then. The other mother had no intention of letting her go or of keeping her word. It had been an entertainment, and nothing more. "Hold on," she said. "We aren't finished yet, are we?" The other mother looked daggers, but she smiled sweetly. "No," she said, "I suppose not. After all, you still need to find your parents, don't you?"
"Yes," said Coraline.
"I must not look at the mantelpiece," she thought. "I must not even think about it."
"Well," said the other mother, "produce them. Would you like to look in the cellar again? I have some other interesting things hidden down there, you know."
"No," said Coraline. "I know where my parents are." The cat was heavy in her arms. She moved it forward, unhooking its claws from her shoulders as she did so.
"Where?"
"It stands to reason," said Coraline. "I've looked everywhere you'd hide them. They aren't in the house." The other mother stood very still, giving nothing away, lips tightly closed. She might have been a wax statue. Even her hair had stopped moving. "So," Coraline continued, both hands wrapped firmly around the black cat,
"I know where they have to be. You've hidden them in the passageway between the houses, haven't you? They're behind that door."
She nodded her head toward the door in the corner. The other mother remained statue still, but a hint of a smile crept back onto her face.
"Oh, they are they?"
"Why don't you open it?" said Coraline. "They'll be there, all right." It was her only way home, she knew, but it all depended on the other mother needing to gloat, needing not only to win, but to show that she had won. The other mother reached her hand slowly into her apron pocket and produced the black iron key. The cat stirred uncomfortably in Coraline's arms, as if it wanted to get down. "Just stay there for a few moments longer," she thought at it, wondering if it could hear her. "I'll get us both home. I said I would. I promise." She felt the cat relax ever so slightly in her arms. The other mother walked over to the door and pushed the key into the lock. She turned the key. Coraline heard the mechanism clunk heavily. She was already starting as quietly as she could, step by step, to back away toward the mantelpiece. The other mother pushed down on the door handle and pulled open the door, revealing a corridor behind it, dark and empty. "There!" she said, waving her hands at the corridor. The expression of delight on her face was a very bad thing to see. "You're wrong. You don't know where your parents are, do you? They aren't there." She turned and looked at Coraline. "Now," she said, "you're going to stay here forever." "No," said Coraline. "I'm not." And hard as she could, she threw the black cat toward the other mother. It yowled and landed on the other mother's head, claws flailing, teeth bared, fierce and angry. Fur on end, it looked half again as big as it was in real life. Without waiting to see what would happen, Coraline reached up to the mantelpiece and closed her hand around the snow globe, pushing it deep into the pocket of her dressing gown. The cat made a deep, ululating yowl and sank its teeth into the other mother's cheek. She was flailing at it. Blood ran from the cuts on her white face, not red blood, but a deep, tarry black stuff. Coraline ran for the door. She pulled the key out of the lock. "Leave her! Come on!" she shouted to the cat. It hissed and swiped its scalpel-sharp claws at the other mother's face in one wild rake, which left black ooze trickling from several gashes on the other mother's nose. Then it sprang down toward Coraline. "Quickly!" she said. The cat ran toward her, and they both stepped into the dark corridor. It was colder in the corridor, like stepping down into a cellar on a warm day. The cat hesitated for a moment, then, seeing the other mother was coming toward them, it ran to Coraline and stopped by her legs. Coraline began to pull the door closed. It was heavier than she imagined a door could be, and pulling it closed was like trying to close a door against a high wind, and then she felt something from the other side starting to pull against her. "Shut!" she thought. Then she said out loud, "Come on, please!" And she felt the door begin to move, to pull closed, to give against the phantom wind. Suddenly, she was aware of other people in the corridor with her. She could not turn her head to look at them, but she knew them without having to look. "Help me, please," she said, "all of you." The other people in the corridor, 3 children, 2 adults, were somehow too insubstantial to touch the door, but their hands closed about hers as she pulled on the big iron door handle, and suddenly she felt strong. "Never let up, miss. Hold strong, hold strong," whispered a voice in her mind. "Pull, girl, pull," whispered another. And then a voice that sounded like her mother's, her own mother, her real, wonderful, maddening, infuriating, glorious mother, just said, "Well done, Coraline." And that was enough. The door started to slip closed, easily as anything.
"No!"
screamed a voice from beyond the door. And it no longer sounded even faintly human. Something snatched at Coraline. Reaching through the closing gap between the door and the doorpost, Coraline jerked her head out of the way, but the door began to open once more. "We're going to go home," said Coraline. "We are. Help me." She ducked the snatching fingers. They moved through her then. Ghost hands lent her strength that she no longer possessed. There was a final moment of resistance as if something were caught in the door, and then with a crash the wooden door banged closed. Something dropped from Coraline's head height to the floor. It landed with a sort of a scuttling thump.
"Come on,"
said the cat. This is not a good place to be in. Quickly! Caroline turned her back on the door and began to run as fast as was practical through the dark corridor, running her